for just about everything for the outdoors. Go to MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Well, y'all, me and the fellas are back out of the mountains, and we found a pile of listener questions filling up the old Elk Bros mailbox. Questions on calling, elk behaviors, season-specific strategies, questions on the wind, scenarios, finding elk, and many, many more. So this show is totally dedicated to you, our listeners. So let's get this party rocking and start cutting some mustard on those questions. That discussion, and our thanks to you, our listeners, with our awesome Elk Bros shout-outs. So, my friends, pull up a chair, adjust your volumes just right, and welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunting.
Welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunting, brought to you by ElkBros.com, with your host, Gilbert Ornelas, and elk hunting coach, Joe Gilly. You want to hunt elk, and they live to hunt elk. Their goal is to share with you what they have learned grinding it out for over 35 seasons doing what they love. So come on into camp and set a spell. Welcome to Blue Collar Elk Hunters.
Hello there, everyone. It's your first time with us. Glad to have you. Hope you enjoy our show. And as always, for those blue collar hunters following us, our show and grinding it out with us every week, welcome back to Elk Camp. I'm Gilbert Ornelas, the host of your show, and from Katy, Texas. That's right. We got the leader of the Venezuelan mafia, Mr. Luis Gonzalez, and from the DFW, the northern leader of the Venezuelan mafia, Mr. Manano Graterón.
Don't introduce me.
New Mexico. That's right. We got your elk hunting coaches in the house. We've got the ninja, Mr. Leroy Chavez, in the house. Give us a deuce, Mr. Leroy. And we got WWJGD is in the house. We got What Would Joe Gilia Do? He's got his new do, Me Too, and everybody else is rocking, ready to go tonight.
And what's if you're watching this on YouTube, yes, he actually paid for that haircut.
Beto, in this world, you keep introducing Luis as a leader of the Venezuelan mafia, bro.
Somebody's got to be the South leader and the North leader. Y'all got it all.
Bro, you got to look, bro. Man, everybody's like, you know, we've been pinning your photograph up on the wall behind us.
Like Bin Laden.
MIA, man. I mean, people are like... what's his name? Minima.
Yeah. I was like, well, see, they miss me. They miss.
They forgotten. Sure do,
no.
Brother.
What he's trying to say is they've forgotten about you.
No. In fact, we've been working on Chav and his beaches and stuff. I mean, Chav's been trying to, you know, have take your place, but it just doesn't work. You know,
it's not near as good.
So tonight, man, guys, we have so many questions that we've gotten, and so many cool questions. And there's people out there right now that are they're hunting elk right now with rifle. Either you've just finished up that late season October, or you got hunts coming up in November. If you're fortunate to have any elk hunts in December, I envy you. I actually think myself that is the best time to kill a big bull is right in December. We can talk about that some other time, but there's still people out there doing stuff. So there's a little bit different modes. There's some things happening there. And we do have questions. Some of these go back to September. Some of them happen in October. And we have people that are concerned about what's happening in these late hunts. So it's a really cool time. And not everybody, you know, is, you know, able to sleep in a, you know, like a mobile motel and hunt pig.
The mafia mobile. Yeah.
That, yeah. The mafia mobile. I called it the mafia motel, man. Myself, for sure. The mafia motel transcend, oh, baby. I mean, it was an amazing trip we had last weekend. And the fellas ain't tent camping no more, Joe.
You know.
The boys have stepped up.
It's not even right, man. I mean, I think it's a sin, isn't it?
I don't know, bro. I know one thing. It was nice to have that air conditioning.
Yeah.
90 degrees.
Beto was sinning every day and asking for forgiveness every night.
Air conditioned. Last time you invited us, it was like 18 degrees.
Ooh, didn't need no air conditioning. It was an
icebox. It got above 90 for, yeah, it was 99 one day.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it was 99 degrees. We hunted at 48 that morning, and it was 99 that afternoon.
Wow. Well, yeah. I tell you what, guys, it's good to see everybody's mug again. I haven't seen y'all in a little while. So we're all back together. We got some people waiting for some information, so let's rock this thing out, man.
You know what time it is. It's time shout for our Elk Bro shout-out. If you're new to our show, this is just shout-outs to a few cities with the most listeners topping our charts this week.
Yes, sir. And I thought it'd be kind of cool. We haven't done this in a while to see what cities and countries since January of, you know, 2022 have made our top 10 listening cities and countries to this point. So we'll do that real quick here. In place in spot number 10, we have Chicago, Illinois. Albuquerque was just out of reach, man.
Oh, man, the 505 didn't show out.
Oh, it was right there with Chicago, man. We're going to send some people over. But in spot number 9, Phoenix, Arizona. In spot number 8. You know, ever since the dude left Cali, everybody else has gotten into hunting. Los Angeles, California.
God left some remnants.
Yeah. Number 7, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Number 6, Houston, Texas.
H-Town.
Representing.
Houston, Texas. Number 5, Salt Lake City, Utah.
Woohoo!
And ahead of Salt Lake in the 4th position was Seattle, Washington.
Wow.
Number 3, ahead of Washington, our Rosie buddies over there, Portland, Oregon.
Right.
And then we've got the battle of the big D's for 1 and 2. Who got it, man? Who got it? Well, we're just going to say Manano hasn't been doing his job up there because runner up for the top listening city was Dallas, Texas, with Denver, Colorado rounding out the lead.
Wow.
There you go,
man.
Yeah. So
that's even with Manano never listening to the podcast.
You know what?
That's impressive.
I don't have to listen. I'm part of it.
I made
a podcast.
I think Dallas only lost by 2 listens, and that was Manano, right?
Yeah.
Manano, man, I want the whole family listening. Let's jack this up, man. So, and for the countries, in the 10th spot, blew my mind. Over there in Maori land, New Zealand.
No way.
Wow.
Cool, dude. New Zealand, we want to come see you. We're going to put a film crew together.
We're going to come see
you guys over there red stag hunting.
What a beautiful country, man. Beautiful country. Yeah. And the 9th spot, Singapore.
Wow, man. Thailand.
Number 8 was Spain.
España.
Homeland.
Yeah, you know, they used to be higher until we got the Venezuela mafia, and they were like, we don't want to listen to those guys, man. They went down like that, man. But number seven was Finland.
Wow. Hey, let me stop you there, Joe. Luis said, when you mentioned Spain, he said the madre patria. So, you know, that is why he can't, he cannot be the Venezuela leader. No.
He's not from Venezuela.
Now, wait a second, but I believe he has, like, dual.
That is what he says, that he's coming from the king or something, like,
the king.
Blood related, whatever, but.
There's a reason why your English sucks, is because you speak Spanish.
Well, but I'm from Venezuela, proudly.
How many languages do you speak, please?
Three.
I speak three.
Three languages? Well, we don't include you as speaking English, so what's the other three?
Portuguese.
English is one. Portuguese, Spanish, and
Spanish.
English. Yeah, and I thought you
French was my first language, but I can't. I understand it, but I can't speak it.
What about Italian? No Italian?
His first language.
No Italian.
He can muddle through some Italian.
And it's aren't you of Italian nationality?
Yes, Italian descent. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only part of you I like.
Yeah, I guess.
Right, so, going in place number six, we have France.
Wow.
Place number six. In fifth place, wie geht's, we have Germany.
Wow. Germany's showing up.
Number in fourth position is Australia.
Okay. Them boys down under getting with it.
Third position, Mexico.
Come on.
And in the second position, United Kingdom. And in first position, all of our brothers to the north, man. Those Canucks up there from Canada.
Canada. Right on. Travis O'Shea, the Canucks are showing up, baby.
Yep, yep. So let's get with it on the listening cities. Chav, you got number one.
Okay, this top listening city thrived as a shipbuilding port and was an early manufacturing center for iron, nails, hats, and carriages. Textile production flourished after 1812, but declined in the 1920s. It is one of the northernmost towns in Massachusetts and is a suburb of Boston. The name comes from the ancient Norman culture in Great Britain and France. It was originally derived from the old French given name or nickname, Amis or Ami, which means friend. And this is Amesbury, Massachusetts, and I think Joe's got somebody who lives up there.
Yeah.
And a bundle coming.
Yeah. Granddaughter number two is due December 12th.
Yay.
And my daughter and my son-in-law, Brittany and Quentin, live in Amesbury. And,
is it really?
Yeah. Wow, that's what's so funny was I called her today and I go, your town is our top listening city. And she goes, you know it ain't me.
You know it ain't me.
She's like, no, Dad, man, I love you guys, but way too much testosterone.
That's funny, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody come in as the top listening city.
Yeah, she's like, what a coincidence, man. That's crazy. She's like, why would people in Amesbury be listening to you? I'm like, well, come on. Give us some kind of credit, man.
Yeah, man. There's a bunch of good like guys that like elk hunting that live up there.
Hey, guys and gals, man. You never know.
Yeah. Well, Joe, this next city is known as the ice cream capital of the world. This city is officially designated as such, and it is the home to Wells Enterprise, which makes Blue Bunny ice cream, founded by Fred H. Wells in 1913. In 1891, a wealthy and influential railroad businessman hosted a party in which the women at the event were asked to name the town. The group submitted an acronym using the first letter of their first names. The acronym was LEMARS. Lemars, Iowa, the home of Blue Bunny ice cream.
Man, if they'd only had three women at that party, that could have been interesting.
They might have been in trouble.
That's interesting how they put that together. That's very
Blue
very
Bunny ice cream is good ice cream.
Yeah,
not to get it confused with Blue Bell, but
yeah.
Blue Bunny is good.
And where's Blue Bell from?
It is from Brenham, Texas. Just a throw joke.
Oh, okay. Well,
when you come down here to H-Town, come see us. You got to go to the Bluebell Factory and go check it out, man. If you like ice cream.
I'm there, dude. I'm there, man. You got German chocolate ice cream?
Oh, they got every flavor you can think of.
Oh, dude, bro. I'm there, man.
All right, next up. This top listening city is located in western New York State. It was first settled in 1806 by Joseph McClure, and became known as McClure settlement. It was finally named after William Temple Franklin, grandson of Benjamin Franklin. Recently, the Great Lakes Cheese Company broke ground for a 480,000 square foot, 500 million state-of-the-art manufacturing and packing plant.
Wow.
And this facility is scheduled to open in 2024 in Franklinville, New York.
Wow.
480,000 square foot. Wow. 500
million. 500 million?
That's a lot of cheese, baby.
That is a lot of cheese. A
lot of cheese.
Yep. Oh my God.
Did I say that? Joseph McCure?
I don't know. Chab typed that out. So I don't know if it's McClure, McCure, but
McClure.
Probably McClure.
Hey, and Joe, any of your descendants, man, they'll get my name wrong too. So don't worry about it, man.
Very cool.
That is like dead center in the middle of New York, a little further south, but south of Buffalo and all that. That's pretty wild looking.
Man, that was really confused me because I saw Great Lakes, so you think Wisconsin, right?
Right.
This is Franklinville, New York, doing this.
It's in the panhandle.
Wow, that's crazy, man.
Pretty cool.
Awesome, awesome.
This top listening city, it's a suburb of Baltimore and a destination for outdoor enthusiasts. Patapasco Valley State Park. Chaff, why did you get all this?
You nailed it, dude.
Which extends for 32 miles on the Patapasco River and a must visit. The city underwent many name changes before settling on its current name in 1930. The town was named after the local district attorney, Elias Glenn. The city was known as Tracy Station, Myrtle, Glensborn, before it settled on Glen Burnie, Maryland.
Wow.
Glen Burnie, Maryland.
Glensborn and then Glenborn. Oh. I don't know if I pronounce it.
Yeah. No, you did great, bro. Glen Burnie.
They got them all.
And I forgot to give the for inquiry, man.
Yeah.
That's it's so cool. Guys, sometimes we forget. You start to take for granted after doing all these cities. Take a look at where all these came from. Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Iowa, Maryland. New York, yeah. Maryland. Yeah. Y'all, we are only here because of y'all, our listeners there. Yeah. And we are just so proud to see people from all of these places all across the United States, tuning in, listening in, to what we have to share and what we have to teach and to all of our BS, man. Thank you guys so much. That's really special. So with that said, we're going to get this party started. We're going to jump into the content. And, we are, like we said, this is from our Elk Bros mailbox. And, what we'll do is, each one of us will just take these as we go along. I didn't assign no names to them. We've got a lot here to answer. We'll do as much as we can. If we have a whole bunch more, we might do a second version of this. We have a lot of things on the horizon. You guys don't know, I'm supposed to be scheduling to do a calling, show with, Bo Brooks and Travis and myself, man. So that's going to be, that's going to be a lot of fun to do that as well.
Y'all need a third wheel, brother. I'll show up.
All right, man. We'll rock and roll it. So let's do with this. And I'll go ahead and jump off with the top one. Somebody else get ready to take the next one. This is from Brad Dormady. And he said, when you talk about early season, you guys are talking around September 1st. Do you think those same early season strategies will also work in late August around the 20th? Yes and no. So the thing is when you're talking about August 20th, it's starting to happen there, but also bulls at that time, because you got to remember during the summer, bulls are bachelored up, right? Yeah. And what starts to happen is bulls now at a certain point, they're starting to feel it a little bit. They're rubbing off. Once they start rubbing that velvet off their horns, and they're starting to, you know, start to develop that itch for heading towards or that transition to the rut, you know, then they start, some of the behaviors change a little bit. But there is a period all that time and up until they actually start moving to locate cows, when they start splitting up from their bachelor groups, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, because not all of them split up. It almost becomes like an age boys club, right? Where the bigger, you know, biggest bulls kind of split off, and some of those guys that are the same, you know, the same
middle-aged
age
bulls
kind of hang out together and stuff. But they are in more of a routine, right? During that summer, where they're basically going to be in areas that they're going to stay in. They almost have their places they want to drink. They're going to have their places where they're going to eat. They're going to have their places where they want to bed. So they are, you are able to pattern bull elk during the summer so much better. And you can pattern them all the way up. Some of them, you know, it might be right there around the 20th, 25th, right in there, where some of them start to move off and start to go into that transition a little bit in our area. Now, this
is
the thing.
I was going to say, Joe, that could be totally different up on the Canadian border, right?
It could be different there. It could be different in Arizona, you know, but I know guys are seeing elk like on their trail cams, you know, at the same wallow. They're seeing those bulls over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And then right there, man, about the middle of August towards that 20th, and they kind of start disappearing off there, right?
Yeah.
So can those strategies work? Absolutely. Because I really think in that first 20th to the 30th, you have some of the same things happening, and you might even have, just like we do at September 1st, you have some of those cows that start to come in heat, or those early cows that come in estrus, and that's all it takes is to, you know, to set off and change those boys' minds from being buddies to not so buddy-ish, right? I absolutely think, and take a look at this year on our season, right? I mean,
yeah, I think we had a lot of summertime bulls around us, Joe, and they left. And they went on looking for you know, early fall cows, and they left that area because there was a lot of sign that was old sign, right? Not years old, but you know, month, week old, 3 weeks old. I mean, a lot of blown up trees and. Then they were gone, you know. So, and I think yes, some of those tactics are going to work because they're early season tactics, you know.
Right.
But depending on where you're at in the on the globe, in the United States, depends on how many states, Joe. Do you know how many of them allow them to hunt into August?
I didn't think.
No, some of the Utah states.
Utah has some that happens that early,
like Idaho, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly on those, but some of them are, you know, starting a little bit early.
And I know Travis and them boys start in the latter part of August up there in
the 25th
Alberta.
Oh, I think So, but the thing is look, you gotta have those multiple tools in your toolbox.
Yeah.
Be ready for spot and stalk. If you're finding that you have a wallow that a bull is hitting, you know, that you're seeing all the time that bull's coming in that area and hitting that area, or you're seeing all that sign, that might be a good proposition for you that early. If you can, you know, get some place where you can use the glasses, if you're in some of that more open country, it depends on what kind of country you're in, whether you're in the thick New Mexico, you're in the thick northern Idaho, or whether you're in more open area in Arizona, or, you know, some of those places in Wyoming. It just depends on what you're doing. So you got to have multiple tools in your toolbox, and you got to apply those to the situation. This year, we had bulls that were very quiet.
Yep.
I mean, even in their responses, very quiet. Mm-hmm. You know, Vinny, our brother Vinny, up there in, works in Alaska, lives in Washington. You know, Vinny's like, dude, I don't get it, man. He said, we were in this one area that they have always acted this way, and they've always done this, and we've always been able to get that. And he said they weren't responding. that we weren't finding the elk where we should. It was like everything was, and you always hear this. People always say the rut is late, right? I don't know. It could be. It might be in one area. It might not be in another area.
Yeah.
So a rut is not an overall thing. It just kind of happens where those cows come in estrus.
Where they're at. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And
one of the things I think will help Brad too, Joe, is if he will go over to our Elk Bros Adventures Academy and check that out. That right there can solve a lot of your problems, brother. Get on our academy. Check it out. Joe goes over some unbelievable content on early season bull hunting, man. So y'all can check it out at elkbros.com.
Yeah. You're just shameless, dude. Yeah. And before Luis starts, I can't tell you how many of y'all out there, listeners that I heard from this year, that just listens to our podcast religiously, has gone through all of them. And we got so many emails and photos of people said, I listen to y'all all the time. And my first year, my second year, and I got it done. So you can absolutely listen to us. But, you know, I tell you what, we do give a lot of nuggets and stuff in that academy.
Oh, it's huge.
Luis?
So next up, we got Jason Bradley. Now, are you sure it was Jason or Jason with an E? I know a Jason Bradley.
Me too.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Yes.
We know a Jason Bradley. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I was asking. So, but anyhow, so his question is, I was listening to your Elk Bros Adventure show and it seemed like you moved from areas that you had found elk. I've also heard you say you shouldn't leave elk to find elk. Is there something I'm missing?
Good question, man.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, and you know what? This is exactly something that Chav and I was talking about, you know, because as a general rule, why would you leave elk to go find elk?
I mean, elk.
Right? And yet you look at us and we were like in some areas where we had an encounter or we had an encounter here, an encounter there, and we ended up going to another area. And I just want to say, you don't leave elk to find elk unless or except, all right? Yeah. Yeah. And what you got to remember is this, Jason, is that elk hunting is a game of odds. You know, it's a game of encounters. The more encounters you have, the more opportunity you have to close the deal, right? You're going to blow so many opportunities. Well, we were busting a hump. And, yes, we had an encounter here, an encounter there, but really working our butt off. So what we were looking for was we were looking for that pond that was stocked a little better.
Yeah, right? We got a load of them.
We were looking to improve our odds.
Yeah, right. And I think that's a better way of saying, in my mind, what I was thinking is like, look, what the numbers were low.
Right. Yeah, and what we found wasn't right.
Yeah, and so in the little encounters we had, you know, you couldn't see a lot of signs. So at that point, early in the hunt, you divide and conquer to try to see where there's more opportunities. And then when we had the encounter the day that Joe Manano and I went up there in the hike of hell, we realized that even if we were to, I mean, yes, we found elk there, but to get there, it'd take half a morning, and to get out of there with an elk, it would just not logistically wouldn't have made sense.
They just didn't want to do the hike again. It only took an hour and a half. They just didn't want to do the hike again.
It was brutal, though.
Let me put it this way. Let me put it this way, bro.
An hour and a half.
Let me put it this way, Joe. We saw elk there, but I would never go back.
And look, man, these guys, you got to understand something. These two dudes, they love to kill elk, man, and they love to eat elk, and we're all that way. And look, even my fat butt, if I can get there, I'm going to go there, right? But I'm telling you, what we found in that area that we left was lots of blowdown, really hard navigable stuff. So a lot of it we left by necessity because we knew even if we did kill something in there, it'd take an act of Congress or a helicopter to get it out, you know? And, so we had to make some decisions on the fly. A lot of it predicated on, we're good at calling in singles, but man, it makes it really hard when you've bumped them and now they're gone out of that area and there's not a lot of other sign to support it.
And that's the other thing I was going to tell you is when we talk about our hunts, like especially, I think they were listening to our adventure show. So that was our coached hunt. And when you are dealing with multiple players in a camp, you know, you sometimes have to have areas so that you can move from one place to the other so that you don't just blow out an area or, you know. Sometimes you got to let an area rest a little bit, you know, so that animals, you know, relax back down if they got bumped or you don't want to keep putting scent in there and push them out. Or
we did something similar with the lower part of the area where we were hunting on the first hunt as well. Mm-hmm. We kind of let it sit for a couple of days, you know, and sure enough, that's where you kill your bull.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we came back. So I think he's got a great observation and it is, you know, clarity is required here for that. Yeah. But another good example is what we did in Colorado last year. You know, the area where Manano and I started hunting, you know, right there towards the end of the hunt, that's where we concentrated most of our efforts because after, you know, realizing that that was probably the best spot, we were kind of in a way taking turns and hitting that area from different angles until, you know.
The other thing you got to consider is just because you're finding an elk in an area doesn't mean that the efficiency or the ability to kill that elk is the best situation. So sometimes they can be in a place where you're just spinning your wheels because of either how the wind's blowing out that day or, you know, whether you're bordering private property and they're jumping onto that or, you know, so there's other
too
things
steep.
You've got to consider every day before you go into a certain area because some areas are more conducive to the morning hunt.
Yep.
Some areas are more conducive to the evening hunt.
Yep.
Some areas are only conducive if you got winds coming out of the west.
Yep.
Or it's going to be a situation where you have, you know, winds coming out of the east, south, or something like that. So it's always important to have your multiple plans, your multiple areas. And even though you know that elk are in plan in area A, if everything's not conducive that day for that, then you're going to let A just chill and you're going to go. But really for us, moving to different places was, especially in our first hunt, was we had to locate lots of areas that a coached group would be able to get to be able to hunt, you know. So a lot of it is just really just, again, we were kind of hunt scouting on the hunt as well and trying to locate a little bit lower hanging fruit. I guess that's the best way to say it. Some of that fruit is really difficult to get to and trying to find something where maybe there's a rut going on in a certain canyon or there's a little bit more elk in an area. Those are reasons that yes, you would just because you're finding one or two in here, you can't just keep chasing them around all the time. You might need to find a little bit greener pastures. Okay.
Yeah. And they'll leave too. You put enough heat on them, they're out.
Yep.
You know, they'll leave the area. So
we have Kurt Hargens, Indiana native. Having listened to many of your podcasts, I'm wondering whether or not calling can be effective in late November. Also, does calling play as much a role in a rifle hunt as an archery hunt? Thanks, guys. Love the podcast.
What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, it probably won't be as effective, but it can be effective in November, late November. You know, the bulls have pretty much, you know, left the cows if it's late November, but you know, they still sound off every so often. So I you know, it can probably work either way. But I don't think it's as effective as an archery hunt. But there is a role. There is a role in calling at that time.
Especially if you want to stop an animal or get him to.
There you go.
Oh, definitely. Yes, definitely so.
And that's the big thing is so I guide all the rifle hunts and one thing that I find is just two different animals, two different beasts, right? So I always have calls with me, but in October, I might do a location bugle. And once I get them located, that's pretty much what I'm doing until I just move in on them. And I'm not going to do bull stuff. I'm pretty much going to cows and I'm staying cow talking. If I was to do anything in November, it's going to be cow calls, if anything. But it's like Gil said, I pretty much have my cow calls to either stop an animal or to get an animal to expose themselves. It's not like I'm going through the woods cow calling trying to get something to come into me. That's not, even though now Chav and I have been in situations where we've gone and just messed around and actually brought a group of cows into us just by cow talking, not doing like rut mews and stuff like that. We were just sounding like a herd and got some cows to come into us. No matter what, you can always bring cows with a lost calf. You can always. You know.
Especially if you're late season cow hunting, you'd get that lost calf going. She's going to try to run you over to find that calf.
But I would not make it my number one source, the calls there. I would, you know, really that's when I talk rifle hunting and I start talking late season, it's different. Whereas you want to cover as much country as possible, you want to use your glasses as much as possible. You really want, I mean, a lot of people, man, will just cover that country to look into areas and the glass areas and get by. And it's all about just trying to locate them. And now you're trying to locate them instead of the north sides. You're looking at the south and you're looking at the west. You're looking at if there's snow at the winds, you know, swept slopes out there. They're still going to be lower down, you know, at a certain time of day and they're going to be a little higher up, but, it's a little bit different. You're going to find big bulls that are by themselves. You're going to find some of them smaller bulls still with the herds at that time. So, it's the calls are not your way of finding elk. And really, I try to tell people that's a skill set you need to have even during the archery season because if they're quiet, you got to have other methods of locating those animals. But it's like different places.
But that, you know, that's a great question. I've asked myself that too. I mean, obviously I have not, you know, been, you know, I've been on the archery side as well. And I wonder, man, if it's so, you know, if we can bring it in so close with archery, why can't you do that during rifle season? Right. And so I think that's
a great,
question.
And I've heard bulls bugling and sounding off in December, but that doesn't mean I'm going to bugle to try to get them to respond to me or to come into me. Yeah, that's not going to happen. So they're not in that mode at that time. Mm. Okay. Mm. And in fact, if you're hunting big bulls, you can forget that, man. They aren't in any mode to be around anybody, man. They're just like
healing up.
They just want to be by themselves. They just want to chill. They don't want anybody bothering them. They're off to be on their own in some gnarly looking places sometimes. But late December, those guys are eating so hard. I mean, they're going to be out longer in the morning. They're going to be out earlier in the evening. If you're looking for other bulls that are bachelored up, Chav and I have seen numbers of 12 bulls bachelored up together. It's a whole lot easier to spot them. And we've seen them in all different age classes, from big all the way down to small bulls.
We got Cody Wells from Lindale, Texas.
Lindale, Texas.
I have heard you guys say over and over that you have called counted coups and killed elk that other people are driving or hunting past. With that limited needs, I would like to be able to capitalize on these areas without having to cover 15 miles to stumble onto them. That means I need to know what elk do after being bumped or pressured. So here's my question. When a group of elk is bumped or avoiding hunting pressure and road traffic, how far do they usually move before resuming normal to semi-normal behavior? I understand it can depend on a number of things, but generally speaking, do they move a couple of miles, more, less? Do they favor moving back up to higher elevation or lower? Or would the distance be better measured by features, as in moving to the closest cluster or of desirable features?
That's a good question, man.
So this is a great question, and I think we all faced this situation in our hunt when we encountered these, I mean, unbelievable, like biblical portion, like Beto says, yeah, blow down. I think it's a matter of they moved away from the high elevation of, because of the blowdown. I don't believe they move away because of the traffic or these joyriders, because we got a lot of them. But we had a few encounters, so that means they still there. They are, you know, a bit bothered because of the traffic and all the hunters, the pressure, but the one that moved, they move away. They went down. I mean, miles.
But it wasn't because of pressure, though. That was just they moved out of the area because they couldn't travel to it.
Yes, because of the blowdown.
Yeah, because of the blowdown. But
not because of the traffic or the or the pressure.
No, I think the traffic limits. I think the traffic puts them into a nocturnal mode. I think they don't want to move around with all that traffic and pressure. So
they learn.
They sit down and they don't have to move around that pressure when it's nighttime. There is no pressure there. So I think what it does is it forces, and this is my own opinion.
Yeah.
I think it forces them into a nocturnal movement mode when they see that type of pressure like we saw. Now, normal hunting pressure, I think they run off 150 yards and watch the traffic go by and get right back to it, especially if they're around a lot of traffic all the time.
Well, I think you hit it on.
Yeah, I think Gilbert hit it, you know, perfectly. They don't take off. You know, some people think that if you spook them, they're miles away. But no, they just go a few hundred yards and settle down.
Now, especially if they're used to traffic.
Yeah. Now, the situation we were in this year, because of the blowdowns, you know, the elk just as a whole, you know, found a safety area away from that wind. You know, and a lot of them didn't come back because of the travel routes are pretty tough. Yeah. You know, this past Sunday, Joe and I went to Springer, which is a little town outside of Cimarron, to do our Sunday brunch. And we saw two elk herds that were out in the open. And it was really windy that day. So I think they left their shelter. With a lot of trees and stuff, they left the shelter because they weren't able to hear anything. They went to an open area where they could look around and see. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that happened up in the mountains too. The majority of the elk in that particular area took off.
Grinders tuning in, thank you for listening to the Blue Collar Elk Hunting Podcast. Our goal is to share our knowledge and help you flatten that learning curve so that you too can have some of the very same incredible experiences that have given all of us here at Elk Bros a lifetime of memories. If you like what you hear or see, you can get all of this information plus so much more from our Basecamp Elk Hunting Training Camp, the first in a series of online courses from our Blue Collar Elk Academy. Our Basecamp Training Camp allows me to use my coaching style and share almost 40 years of elk hunting experiences successfully hunting elk on public lands, as well as over 20 years guiding hunters of all ages and experience levels. This course will be like nothing you have ever experienced in concept and structure, using success-based coaching techniques that will elevate your confidence and skill sets. Our camp will prepare you specifically from that final moment most in your control, those final minutes or seconds the elk is in front of you, backwards through each step and level, allowing you to see, visualize, understand, and relate every coaching point to what lies ahead, the next step, the next thought process, the next success. Because y'all, you've already been there. You know what it looks like. By tapping my 30 years of teaching and coaching experience, our camps are developed considering multiple learning modes with text, visuals, audio, as well as video. And Basecamp will benefit those new to elk hunting all the way to the 10 to 15 year vet. So if you are looking for that one thing to help you fill that tag this year, invest in the most important piece of equipment there is, you and your elk hunting knowledge. You can find the Blue Collar Elk Hunting Academy and the Basecamp Training Camp at elkbros.com. That's ELKBROS.com. Keep dreaming of the screaming, believing in achieving, and most of all, keep grinding.
Some were safe, and a lot of them didn't come back. So
yeah, so here's the other thing, too, is we always see things in a certain perspective, but how far elk go when they're bumped and how, you know, soon they come back and things like that has to do with a lot of things. How much use is in that area all the time? How open or how dense is that area? Because the thicker the woods, the less distance they're going to go.
Exactly.
The more open the area, like when you start getting those alpine areas up there and you bust a group of elk, next thing you know, they're going like two over mountains on that alpine, man, because it's so wide open and they're vulnerable. Elk are going to go where they can feel secure, where they're not
secure.
So vulnerable, right? And that's what Chad's talking about. I mean, that group of elk, y'all, it was a herd, I don't know, it was probably 150 head. You know, and they're out standing up in the middle of the prairie like muskox would, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and then we saw another group that was bedded in the middle of the prairie because they were most safe there because the wind, when they were in the brush, too much was moving. They couldn't use their ears. They just didn't feel safe, and they're down there where predators can get to them. So they changed that. And yeah, go ahead, man.
We got a good example of our season on Colorado. Mm-hmm. The bull that you saw, that was the Luis's bull. Mm-hmm. So you were there. You can't kill on him. And then Luis killed that bull in the same exact spot. Then Luis drew on the Beto's bull on the same exact point.
We both did. You and I both drew on that bull.
Yeah, I drew on him. Yeah, and then Beto killed him 2 days after.
Later.
And I want people to realize that what Manano's talking about, where we killed, most people were driving by. There was a ton of traffic in that area. There were people camping, and we killed elk, even though people are going 2 miles back, 3 miles back, 4 miles back, and they're leaving a camping area like NASCAR. We killed elk within a mile of those camps.
Yeah.
So those elk, you know, felt secure, number one, where they were.
They didn't
feel people like intruding on them. If they got bumped because of the type of terrain, the way it was up, down, thick, and everything, they didn't go too far, right? Mm-hmm. So if you end up with a lot of pressure with people, and it's different rifle season and archery season, I think that people have a tendency to show themselves more during the rifle season and walk a lot on top of those ridges to glass and stuff like that. And when you start seeing a lot of people on all these ridges, it'll start pushing elk in a direction. And you're right on that. You know, Cody, if you're in an area and you know elk are staying down in the bottom and people are going to put pressure on it down there, find a saddle, man. Find a saddle that they're going to go over to get into the next ridge or the next drainage on the other side. You know, you don't have to go that far. And, you know, pay attention to those areas, man. I killed my bull this year. I could hear the traffic from the highway. I could hear voices from a house 3/4 of a mile away. There was a forest road.
Yeah.
I mean, how far was a forest road that you guys came in from to get access into there?
Not far. And there was another four-wheeler road that you could access off the highway.
Yeah.
There was traffic all around where I killed this bull and called them in an area where they were bedded off in just a little hidden canyon, right? So, just because bulls and elk do not just run off and disappear into an area. Now, I can tell you this. Elk are going to move a lot more during the rut than they are in those other times of years because they're more predictable before and after the rut once they start staying in an area. If you have a bull that, an old bull that is kind of holed up in a place where he can have security, food, and water, he's going to kind of stay there. But during the rut, not only are hunters pushing them, but other bulls are pushing them as well. All right. So
in some areas, they just move through, mm-hmm. right? They don't stay there. They just move through that area to get to a destination. Right. So those areas like that are just, they're not being bumped. They're just moving through that area to get to where they're going in their routines. Cause they're definitely creatures of habit.
And as they get in,
2 miles, and it can be 2 or 3, 4 miles, man.
Depending on where the water is that they got to be at. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Joe, when we were hunting in our normal place, those elk will go 3 or 4 miles to go to water. Mm-hmm. Right. And you'd watch them. The migration of them moving back and forth, you know, we catch them in the middle of it. And I mean, I'm not talking about 1 or 2 elk. I'm talking about 200 elk, you know? So, I mean, I hunted one time with Carl Gamage in the middle of the Valdez late December. My son was 9 years old and he had a cow tag for Logan and we pulled up, went up the Windy Gap side. Came out the backside into the Valdez right there and boom, you know, here we are. You're going to have to edit that joke. Anyway, here we are hunting. We came up this backside of this canyon, popped out into a big field where we were with Carl Gamage. And I say a big field. I mean, we're talking 100 and something acres, you know, and here they are all out in the middle of the daggum park. You know, I mean, 250, 300 head of elk, bulls, cows, you name it. And, you know, the pressure from public, the pressure from private, the whole nine yards, it moves the elk for sure, but they have their own thing that they do every day. Right. And it's dictated in the rut by how these bulls are pushing everybody around.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, and it depends, like, all their features. How close is their food, their water, and their shelter? Do they have to go very far? Some of them will just, I mean, we also had elk that they would travel up, I don't know, a half mile to bed down and then a half mile down to feed, you know?
Yeah.
You got some of them, man, that they got to go a lot further. Just depends on where their features are, right? Yeah. So you just got to kind of put all of that in. Like the elk in this lower area where we were hunting this year, for them to go to fresh water, it was going to take them, they had to go 2 miles to 4 miles just to get to fresh water. So it just kind of depends on stuff.
I was going to mention that. I mean, there's so many different ways to answer that question. Yeah. And it's so topography and climate dependent and, you know, resource dependent too, you know,
right.
And so, yeah, I think you guys have touched on all the points, but great question because it, you know,
their travel routes are one, thing, being bumped is another.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Being bumped by just a car driving by and being bumped by, you know, somebody shooting at them with a rifle, way different deal. You know?
Yeah. And if you bump them out of their bedding area, they're going to go to another bedding area they feel safe. That could be in another drainage. It could be through the next drainage to the one over top of it, you know? Yeah. So it just depends on how far they got to go. But honestly, I'm with Chad, man. I have watched elk, man, that have been bumped and they just ran up on a ridge about 200, 300 yards, just stayed there listening till everything calmed down, then went back into what they were doing. I've seen animals go around camps, and I've seen them wait for vehicles to pass roads before they cross. So,
seen them walk through camps.
Yep.
Seen them walk right through camp.
Absolutely.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
It says, Keenan, I guess it's Keenan Gibson.
Yeah, Keenan.
He says, do you have a podcast that covers dealing with missed opportunities from wounding an animal? Well, we've all, listen, Keenan, if you bow hunt enough, we're all gonna suffer this consequence, right? I mean, it just happened. We make some mistakes and things happen. Sometimes we feel like we put a really good shot on an animal and just for one thing or another, these things happen. So I want you to know you're not by yourself, my brother. He says, I shot a 5x5 bull at 50 yards at what seemed to be totally broadside. Shot looked and felt great. Bull ran off with my arrow, but I could tell it did not get great penetration. Okay, so that tells you something right there. He stopped after the arrow kicked out around 40 yards and just stood there for a few minutes. I was certain he was going to fall. He eventually slowly walked to a fence line, stopping at 82 yards, showing little desire to jump it and reunite with his cow. I cow called to him to try to get a follow-up shot, but he wasn't interested. And only open ground between us, so I couldn't close the distance. He jumped the fence approximately 5 minutes later and slowly walked in a 10-yard increment about out into a meadow of native grass before stopping in a thick patch 100 yards out. He stood in the same spot for 13 minutes, acting like he wanted to bed there. It's because the bull's in shock, right? And he says, then a road hunter came along the road, stopping his truck, glassing him, and then shining a spotlight at him.
Oh, no.
I don't understand it. Why would he shine a spotlight at the bull? This spooked him, and he ran off into the timber, never to be seen again. I found my arrow, which had 5 inches of good red blood on it and 5 inches missing that he took with him. Thinking I got a single lung hit, I gave him 4 hours before attempting to recover. It had rained all day that day, only letting up before evening hunt. Then it rained again for about 15 minutes after sundown. Bye-bye blood trail. I was able to find a good pool of blood at the fence where he stood before jumping. That would be the last blood we found. I grid searched in the ridge and we last saw him until 3 a.m. Slept for a couple hours, then resumed the search at sunrise and continued until sundown of our last day. We had to leave home for the following morning. The landowners continued to look for signs such as scavengers, him returning to the herd, etc., but no luck. I was obviously distressed about it all week and was unable to let it go. Fortunately, my wife is very supportive and understanding and encouraged me to make the 10-hour one-way drive back to Colorado to look for him again. Dedicated. This trip proved unsuccessful as well. The landowners did get a blurry pic of what we appeared to be a 5x5 bull with a spot on his front shoulder, the same height as my arrow was sticking out. They're going to continue to look for scavengers and for more trail cam pics of him. I got a feeling what happened, but I'm not going to say anything yet because I ain't read it. At this point, I'm assuming he lived and that my shot was further forward than I thought. I can live with that, mostly knowing that he didn't suffer or go to waste. You're right. But the missed opportunity doesn't make it any easier. Luis is going to talk about this. As you can all relate, I've had an archery bull goal dream in my mind for a very long time. Have worked so hard, trained so hard, studied, and prepared for that opportunity, only to have it fall through my fingertips. It's heartbreaking to say the least. Amen. I have plenty of whitetail season and a second goal of 3 bucks in 3 different states and the season is still intact. However, I'm still hung up on this bull / missed opportunity. If you have advice or recorded podcasts that discuss this, please let me know. Appreciate all you guys do. P.S. I'm shooting a Matthews Triax, 70 pounds, gold tip hunter, 340 grain arrows, and was using a Grim Reaper mechanical broadhead. I know I should have used a G5 fixed that was in my quiver instead. Lesson learned there.
So before we even begin to answer this, look, that was a long piece to put in there, and I went through it, and I did not cut it down because I felt like there are thousands of people that this story fits.
100%.
Right? And I bet there were so many people that were going, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, you know, it happens like this. And all the way to like the rain part, you know, everything. I mean, there's so many people that could relate to this story. So I thought it was critical.
Had it happened to me this weekend, brother.
Yeah. So. I thought this was a great one to talk about, and who wants to hit it first?
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, my brother. I knew it was in his wheelhouse, man.
And it wasn't a 340 grain arrow. That was gold tip 340. Spine. So
340 spine.
Well, that's a spine.
Yeah, that's a spine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, man, I know exactly. You know, to Joe's point, I'm reading this and. I'm reliving, similar situations. And I think any bow hunter that tells you they've never been through this, they're going to be lying. I think we all have been through this, and I respect and admire you reaching out and asking, and also driving back to continue to look for that bull. You know, I hear you. I respect that. That is, you know, admirable, and you know, we'd love to see that. So kudos to you for doing that.
That bull's fine though, brother.
Yeah, that's the other point I wanted to make. Absolutely. Your bull is alive. 5 inches of nothing. Penetration is nothing for a bull like that. You probably found initial blood, but you mean that bull is going to heal and it's going to be fine. And I think you know that too. I get it. It sucks. So, with all of that being said, you're shooting for plan A. Your arrow setup is for plan A. And sure, can you kill a bull with that setup you shot?
Absolutely.
Yes, you can. Your
explain
shot place.
If I shot plan A though.
Huh?
Well, explain what you mean by plan A.
Meaning your shot placement has to be perfect.
Yeah. Plan A.
In order to be able to kill the place.
Yes, it has to be.
Your shot placement has to be perfect for that setup to work, right? So one of the things that I've learned after feeling the way you're feeling and starting to look into this is like, there's a way to improve your setup to where, you know, you're prepared for plan B. When your shot placement is not perfect, but you're still getting penetration because you got a better arrow setup. So think of your arrows the same way as you think of your calipers on a gun. Yeah. You know, when you shoot a rifle and you're planning to shoot a deer with a rifle, Beto, you're the rifle expert here. You know, what calipers do you shoot a deer with?
Yeah, I mean, everything from I'm going to use a 270 to a 30 caliber, right?
270. 22, man. Yeah. I mean,
okay.
I mean, you can shoot them with a 22 250. You can shoot them with a 243, but you better be in the right spot.
Shot place. Right. Same thing, right? So what if you're going to go and hunt a moose or a buffalo?
But 300 plus, 338, Lapua, right? 7 mag, probably on the lighter scale of that, man.
It's no different.
Shot placement and bullet tight.
It's no different, right? So here is an example. You get a guy standing up in front of a crowd with a ping pong ball. Ping pong. Okay. He bounces it off on the ground. He stands in front of the crowd and he throws it at the crowd. People in the crowd are going to raise their hand to try to catch it, right? Try to catch the ball in the air, right? And, because, you know, it's just the same size as a ping pong ball. It's light and they're going to catch it. Now the same guy grabs a golf ball and You don't know what a ping pong ball is?
Bro, I'm just trying to stay with you, man.
No, I got it.
Okay, the next guy grabs a golf ball. Yeah. Almost the same size as a ping pong ball, but way heavier. Ooh, now the guy throws it at the crowd. What's the crowd going to do?
The crowd
knows that ball is going to hit him harder.
Bringing a bowling ball, dude.
Because that one, it's heavier. Okay. Yeah. So you have to concentrate on what's actually making contact with the animal. And, you know, it's not how fast it's leaving your bow. It's just how it's being delivered to your animal. And so look, and there's great information out there. I'm reading a book that Mr. Kirkpatrick gave me. It's excellent to discern all this information. It's called, Can't Lose Bow Hunting. And the book starts with an introduction very similar to yours.
Yeah.
And explaining, all the science behind it in a really nice way. And so my point to you, the G5 fixed, yeah, probably better than your Grim Reaper, but not, probably not your best choice as far as broad hits go. So point being is when you plan for a good arrow setup, you got to think plan B. You have to have an arrow that is adequate for the game that you're taking. And plan B means that animal is a live target. It's going to move. You want to make sure that the arrow has the capability of penetrating, all the way through, regardless of the angle in which that animal is. I mean, if you get through bone, then, you know, you want to make sure you get through it. This weekend, I shot a hog and, with a heavy arrow setup. That arrow.
How heavy was it? Tell him.
This weekend was 710 grains.
Yeah.
All arrow weight. But that's my elk hunting setup. But I use it for hogs because hogs are extremely tough. Mm. And if you saw the plates that these hogs that we killed this weekend had.
2 inches thick.
Yeah. Even that arrow wasn't on the second hog I shot, didn't go all the way through because it went through the first plate. It went through ribs on the side, went through the organs and then broke completely the other shoulder. And dislodged the leg completely from the shoulder blade and just broke it, shattered it. Okay. Now the arrow stuck in the hog, but it made the two holes. It broke through the plate on the other side. Now that hog ran probably 10 yards and landed about 10 seconds. It broke my arrow. I was upset because those arrows are expensive when you build them that way, but it did its job. That arrow worked for plan B. If I would have shot that hog with any other arrow setup, it probably would have not gotten the penetration that this one did. So, That's my rant, and I'm gonna stay off the podium now.
I think it's perfect, brother. Because I'm gonna harken back to I've been saying I could shoot through a hog plate, no problem. And I had an absolute dinosaur come in on me this weekend. I'm talking if I've ever seen a hog that's close to 300 pounds, this hog was close to the 250-300 pounds. I mean, he was
Russian
absolutely
boar.
Big, huge Russian boar. He walked in like Genghis Khan, turned a couple of times sideways. And brother, I mean, he wouldn't let, he ran off. He ran off three other pigs, right? Uh-huh. That he wouldn't let him eat around him. He's a giant boar hog. I drew back with my setup that Luis Gonzalez has built me and I proceeded to shoot him high in the shoulder. Now look, part of that's me missing my spot, but listen, I shot him right in the middle of the shoulder because I wanted to. I wanted to see exactly what happens. Yeah, that hog shook. Now, it almost knocked him all the way down. But when he got to his adult best, right, when he got up on his feet, right, he took off with my arrow, and my arrow might have went a foot into him. Maybe 8 inches, right, into him. But it did. There was way – I've never seen an animal tote that much arrow after I hit him and him –
walked and run through the woods off with my arrow, and I never got it back. I was more hurt that I never got my dang arrow that my brother Luis built me back. And I knew. I'm like, oh, dude, I missed that so bad. I shot him for 26. He was 22. And also I had grabbed another broadhead and screwed it on there because I wanted to see if that broadhead worked in my system. Well, that arrow that Luis had built me was built for 150 grain setup. I had 125 grain broadhead on there. So I was 25 grains light, already shooting 4 inches high, and I hit the rascal high. We planned for plan A, shooting him right through the bottom side of the shoulder and busting his shoulder blade and all that. Not the dadgum plate that's above all of that and me shooting him high, right? So, but had I had a 700 grain arrow, I don't know if that would have made a difference. Luis shot a hog in the same type thing, not with a single bevel, same thing. Hit that hog, you know, in the very top part of the shoulder, blah, 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 and he ran off with the Luis's arrow, never to be seen again. So we get where you're coming from, brother, and we've all been there. So what we do going forward, we set up for plan B. When we hit heavy bone, can we come back from that?
So,
and look, that may happen and it may not happen. We may not come back.
You increase your chances.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So there's a couple other things that I wanted to mention here. Well, first of all, before I do that, Keenan, I just want to say, dude, great effort on coming back and all of that, man. Our tip of the hat to you for, you know, paying honor to that animal to try to find it. But at the same time, with that said, there's a couple of areas though. The first time you shot it, that bull stopped at 40 yards out and stood there.
Put another one in.
Should have had another arrow in that bull at that time. Yeah. You know, I, even though in your head you're thinking, oh, he's going to go down. If he's standing there like that and giving you that shot, put another arrow in that animal.
Till they fall over.
Okay. Don't wait because
80 yards. I'm sending another one.
And yeah, I mean,
90. I'm sending another one.
You gotta make sure, you know, and that's one way to do it. Then you see him walking off and now you're like wanting to try to get a shot and now it's too late. Yeah. So that's one thing. The other thing was you made the comment, Bud, that, and I have no doubt that you worked hard. I have no doubt that you trained hard. And you studied for, and that you prepared for the opportunity to only have it fall through your fingertips. However, you did not avoid possible failure points, man. And what I mean by that is the moment that you put a mechanical broadhead in, you set yourself up for a failure point right there. Yes, and it was a lesson learned, but that again is after the fact because in your preparation, you should have, you know, known that unless it's shot in the perfect, and even at that, man, even at that, I would never use a mechanical because they do what they're designed to do. They're designed to open up inside an animal. So that keeps you from getting two holes. We preach two holes. And do I know everything? Have I not made mistake? You know, am I mistake free? Absolutely not. That's why I'm sharing this with you, man. That's why we share failure points because we've had these failure points on this. So in your studies, in your preparation, your equipment, what you're using, now you've heard about the heavy arrows. Now you know about the broadheads and about the second shot there. But the other one is shot placement. You said that the shot looked and felt good. So you looked like you were shooting for that golden triangle or right up from that shoulder like you would a whitetail, man. And we always, you know, and go check out our shot placement
podcast
on YouTube. You can see it on our podcast. But we go up that leg 3 to 4 inches back mid-body, man. We are not aiming for that shoulder. We want two holes through those ribs. If he's quartering away, we're aiming at the leg on the other side, those types of things. So even though you worked hard and you trained hard, there were a couple things that you did not prepare yourself for and which were the most critical.
Yeah.
When that shot hit that animal, what was going to happen with that and where you hit that animal at, right? So
you got a foot behind that shoulder, brother.
Absolutely.
I'm telling you, got a foot back there to get to them good lungs.
That's a hard one. That's a hard one to get used to. It's hard for me, you know, cause I'm I'm used to shooting these pigs forward and low.
Right.
Right. So I can relate. I can relate to it, but the anatomy of the animals are different.
Different.
And so, I have a problem hunting pigs because I always want to shoot them further back, man. And
that's not the, yeah.
You know, that's not the spot.
So I think, you know, the spine is another issue, right? I mean, the way your spine is, depending on how big of a guy you are, if you got a bigger draw length, you know, you're probably under spine as well. So there is a lot of things that you can look into. Like Joe was saying, the YouTube channel, there's also a little deal where I talk a little bit about the arrows and how to kind of build your arrow setup, you know, according to you, because you got to understand your bow, your arrows, it's everything designed, it's customized for each hunter. It's not like somebody else can grab my bow and my same arrow set up and shoot the same, because it's not going to happen. We've tested this, you know, and, so I, you know, you're more than welcome to email us if you need to.
Yeah, reach out. Luis@elkbros.com.
Yeah, Luis@gmail.com.
It's not Luis. It's L-U-I-S-E. I mean, he looks a little, you know, but
it's
Luis,
L-U-I-S at elkbros.com. Feel free to reach out, man. I can call you back and we can, you know, I love talking about this subject and we'll try to figure out what works best for you.
Look, man, this guy builds the baddest arrows I've ever shot in my life. I've got the kills to prove it. I've got the slow-mo motion of my arrows leaving. And I'm telling you, I put them to the test this weekend and you cannot even though when you got the best setup, shot placement is the most important
thing. Yeah, it's key. It happened to me as well.
And
it is,
you could have even had a well-placed shot arrow. And with that mechanical, you might have had some issue with penetration. And
I watched Chav shoot a bull with a mechanical end. I was there. I watched him shoot a bull with a mechanical. He didn't hit a limb with his broadhead. He actually hit it with the tail of the arrow. It prematurely opened the broadhead. And this ain't no little bitty bull, brother. It's a 1,000-pound giant. I mean, it was an absolute honker of a bull. And when he hit that little limb, it opened that broadhead up. And when it hit that bull, he hit him in the 10 ring, dude. I'm not talking about the shoulder. I'm talking about the 10 ring. That bull, another 4 inches, 5 inches of penetration, and we got a hard shot bull, and we're celebrating. That arrow penetrated that far into that bull, and that bull's walking the face of this earth today.
It like hung there, right? Yeah, it like
kind of. Yeah, it hung there, and then him and another bull got in a fight, and it came out in the middle of the fight. You know, so, I mean, it was crazy. And how far did we trail that bull on our hands and knees, Chav?
Oh, we trailed it uphill. A long way.
All the way to the top of the damn mountain. I mean, it was crazy how far that bull went. And he bled the whole way, man. You know, and look, man, we don't talk mess about other people's broadheads. You know, those mechanicals are good for what they do.
Yeah.
But when we make a mistake, I'm telling you, they make you feel like you feel right now, brother.
When you shoot a deer with a mechanical in the right spot,
it's devastating.
Yeah.
So with that said, we want to thank you, Keenan, for your question.
Yeah, man.
Guys, so everybody else knows out there that, you know, that's our show today as far as the amount of time goes. We're going to continue on our questions and we're going to go to Tatum Holliday, Adam Vesser, Ben Shadley, Graham Miller, and more than that. We're going to talk about, he wants to know about cold calling scenarios. We have a guy, asking about, sequences for solo hunter, how to do that. We have people that are looking now moving to a rifle season and those strategies, how that differs. We talked a little bit about that tonight. And we have some things about wind and more items that we will have next week on next week's show. So, and who knows, guys, maybe we'll do that one live. Maybe we'll do that one live on YouTube and get some questions from everybody else. We'll see what that looks like if that's possible. So, Gil, close us out, man.
Absolutely. Man, what an awesome show. Fantastic questions from our listeners out there, Joe. I love doing this because this is what the listeners want. They want to hear their questions on our show. They want to hear the answers from our success squad. I mean, these guys are the real deal. We've been through all of these things. Keenan, we feel for you, brother, but keep slinging them, man. Get with Luis. I promise you he can help you out. Guys, if you like what we're doing, please subscribe, rate, and review us. You got to go to Apple Podcasts or iTunes to review us, and you can check out more elk hunting content at elkbros.com. And if you want to see some of our antics on YouTube, we got a YouTube channel too. Y'all go check us out there. And just a reminder, if any of our listeners would like their questions answered on our show, just send your questions to info@elkbros.com. That's info@elkbros.com. Like we say down here in the Lone Star State, husbands kiss your wives, wives kiss your husbands, hug your babies, keep your broad head sharp and your powder dry. And we'll see you next week right here on Blue Collar Elk Hunting.
And whose music? Whose music?
And for all our grinders out there, here is some more music from our brother from the West, Mr. Tony Wintrip, to close out the show, Joe.
Good night, everybody. Peace, peace.
I got a whole bag of tricks for 5x5s and 6x6. Whether there's snow or a bit of rain, or that mountainous terrain, I got a pair of boots that fit just right, and Phelps calls get 'em close to my side. When I pull the string and I watch that carbon hit, I just elk it. Man, I just elk it. I just elk it. I waited 350 days. I watched the wind blowing from all ways. And I watched the path that he walked in the fall. And there's no failure in my head when all I'm tracking is red. With the fist pump to the sky when the beast is dead. I just elk it. Oh man, I just elk it. I just elk it. A baseball bat. His body's as big as a rodeo bull. I'm a cowboy on his back. I slip the buck knife under his skin. I quarter him up with a big old grin. And I feel the pack with the gold that I'm gonna be eating. I just elk it. Oh man, I just elk it. I just elk it. This rack is turning heads upside down. The cooler's on and he's gonna start chilling on down, down, down. I just elk it. Man, I just elk it. Oh, I just elk it.